listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
A visit back to her childhood apartment building in the Bronx inspired writer-photographer Arlene Alda to track down the stories of some of the renowned artists, actors, athletes, writers, and scientists who've also have roots in the borough. For her book, Just Kids from the Bronx, Telling It the Way It Was, Arlene interviewed over 60 Bronx natives, including Al Pacino, Carl Reiner, Bobby Bonilla, Mary Higgins Clark, and Neil deGrasse Tyson, and as a result, created a colorful portrait of the borough spanning across generations from the early 20th century until today. It's published by Henry Holt, and I'm very pleased to welcome Arlene to our show, and I'm happy that she's brought along her husband, Alan Alda. Alan, welcome back to our show.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much.
And we're so glad to be here. Here's $100 in cash. That's worth $150.
That's $150 right there.
Do we get like a bag for that or anything?
You can get a bag. You can get more than a bag.
And happy anniversary.
Happy anniversary.
I hear it's the 30th anniversary of your show.
Tomorrow, March 5th. I started March 5th, 1985, on a per diem basis. And I thought it was just a stopgap job before I went back to the record business. Here I am 30 years later. And there is no record business anymore.
Wise choice.
Arlene, did you often return to the Bronx neighborhood that you grew up in?
Yeah, I was lucky in that I had continuity. My parents lived in the same apartment until they passed away. My father lived there, and he died at age 93. So he died in the mid-80s. So I kept going back there. My sister lived nearby, nieces, nephews. So it was great.
What was the neighborhood like? Was it changing over the years?
Yes and no. I mean, it changed slowly. The ethnic groups changed. But I always had the feeling that the spirit was the same. It was always kind of an immigrant neighborhood, and I think it still has that feeling.
What about the building you lived in, the Mayflower?
Yeah, the Mayflower. Well, my parents always said, oh, my God, the Mayflower, where we live, it's the best building in the neighborhood because it has this big courtyard, and which we call the garden. The building, unfortunately, over the years, this has to do with technology. We had what were called incinerators, and you threw the garbage down a chute, and I used to love to do that. One of my jobs was go to the incinerator, throw the garbage, and there were sparks that came up. I thought that was the greatest thing. Well,
and only later did you realize that you were causing pollution.
Not only pollution, the whole building could have burned down. But that aside, okay, so that gets you can't do that anymore. So
I was wondering
where does
about
the
that
garbage
because I had,
go?
Because we had it, well, the garbage goes into garbage cans, but we had an incinerator in any number of the buildings that we lived in because my family moved around a lot. I just realized recently that I don't see incinerators anymore.
Right.
There
well,
are still those chutes in some buildings.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, in the Mayflower, what happened was, and this is more recent because I went back very recently, and what I saw were huge recycling bags in the courtyard. So that what were gardens are no longer gardens. You know, that's the repository for the garbage bag. That made me sad. But, you know, maybe they'll be more creative in the future.
You suggest in the book that this actually was inspired when you found out that the chairman and CEO of J. Crew also came from similarly humble beginnings.
Mickey
Drexler. From the same building.
Same building.
Did you know him when you were a kid?
No. And the funny thing is, I hadn't met Mickey at all prior to the time that I did meet him. But he lived across the courtyard, one floor below us. So I could have easily shouted down to Mickey. But Mickey was 11 years younger, so when I was in high school, he was still a little kid, and I didn't really know him.
Well, this is a book also about generations of people living in a borough. It's a fairly large borough. Yeah. 65 interviews here. How did you track down everybody?
At first, it was kind of random. It was helter-skelter random. Mickey was a friend. Regis Philbin, great friend. Marty Bregman, friend. Manny Eisenberg. These were friends who I knew had lived in the Bronx or brought up in the Bronx. And then I also knew I was kind of painting myself into a corner. These are people that I not only knew, but they were of the same generation, more or less. And what I knew I wanted to do was to get a broad picture.
So you write that the narratives of changing decades and disparate times link arms with each other.
Yeah, it's beautiful. You know, the younger people that I met have all had the same aspirations that we all had, and they all have funny stories or not so funny stories to tell, but they're full of the place where they were brought up, and it was very instructive and very interesting to me.
And it does track the changes that took place through these very personal individual stories. You see the macrocosm, not just of the changes in the Bronx, but the changes in the whole country after the war years and that kind of thing. It's a very interesting story to tell, where I don't think Arlene ever really points to it specifically and says, look at the bigger picture, but you see the bigger pictures through these individual stories.
Where did you grow up?
I was born in Manhattan, but I grew up all over the country because my father was a traveling actor.
So were you even aware of the neighborhood in Manhattan? Have you ever returned to it?
The neighborhood where I was born? I was only there on and off for a couple of years, but I did go back later and looked at the stoop of the brownstone where I was born.
How did you and Arlene meet?
We met.
You've been married 58 years?
Coming up.
In a week or so, 58 years. We met on 68th Street on the west side at somebody's apartment where Arlene was playing chamber music. She was playing Mozart clarinet quintet. She's a wonderful clarinetist in addition to all these other things she does. And we met, and there's this story about how we...
You connected over a piece of rum cake that fell to the floor.
It fell off the refrigerator and fell on the floor. And Arlene and I were the only two who went in with spoons and ate it off the floor. This is anybody who
Because
does
you were
this.
Poor kids?
No, because that was
just
a chance.
Hungry?
There was a chance to flirt over a piece of food.
Not only that, I mean, how great is that to do something crazy? You know, we were young and...
And knew, therefore, we were meant for each other.
And you said, Arlene, in a recent New York Times interview, that boys from Manhattan didn't date girls from the Bronx. It was too long a trip. You said, he took me home to the Bronx, unheard of.
I didn't know it was unheard of.
Don't tell him. No, it was terrific. However, he did go to school in the Bronx. He went to Fordham University, which was terrific because he'd finished classes and he'd come over. I was living with my parents at the time, knock on the door, and we'd go out for a date, strolling in the park. I was a cheap date, you know.
But I learned an awful lot about the Bronx, and not in those years when I was going to school there. But as Arlene's been working on this book, I've been reading the stories. But then I did most of the men's voices in the audio book version of Arlene's book. And it's a funny thing that happens when you're playing somebody. You momentarily inhabit them. And I was living through some of these stories that were very, at times, touching and at other times very funny. And I got a view of the Bronx that I had never got before, thanks to the way she edited these stories.
Well, that was an acting job, but you seem to be all over the place. There was an article in yesterday's Science Times about a program you're running at the Center for Communicating Science at the Journalism School in Stony Brook. And right. So you've returned to academia?
I have. I'm a so-called visiting professor there. But we're doing wonderful stuff. We're getting my colleagues and I there are helping start centers for communicating science at universities around the country. Four universities or institutions have affiliated with us, and more are on the way. And scientists, we're finding, are really happy to learn to communicate better, and we have some techniques that are unusual.
Well, getting back to your childhood in the Bronx, Arlene, it does sound like something that I recognize from my own background, living in a one-bedroom, one-bathroom apartment with a family of five and with a dog as well, with immigrant parents. And you say you watched your mother spend endless days and nights working as a housewife, cooking, cleaning, shopping, washing, clothing her kids, and being on call for whoever, which became such a clear message to you not to end up like her.
Yeah, it was interesting.
If you'd stayed in the Bronx, you think that the world that opened up for you wouldn't have?
Well, there were two things going on, and this is in hindsight. If we had larger quarters, I think whatever that chafing was and whatever I didn't like about her life would not have impacted me so strongly. But I knew that this was not something I was going to do. And fortunately, she was very supportive of me. And education, she knew, was the way out.
In such close quarters, how did you practice your clarinet?
Oh, they were so tolerant. Oh, my God. Well, by then, I didn't start clarinet until I went to high school. I had played piano before that, and not very well. But clarinet was my passion. So by the time I started clarinet, my brother was out of the house. My sister was almost out of the house, and they were very tolerant.
And you say that your mother had an immigrant's dream for you. It sounds like that was shared by many of the parents in the generation that you've written about, former New York Times executive editor Abe Rosenthal, Mary Higgins Clark, the theater producer Manny Eisenberg. Was Mary Higgins Clark encouraged to write when she was growing up? Didn't she start writing just because she suddenly found herself unmarried, deserted by a husband, if I remember correctly?
I'm not sure about that. But what I know of Mary Higgins Clark and from what she told me was, her father died when she was 11. So she was very much aware of scrambling for money. And her mother rented out rooms in their house. They lived in a house. They were, I would say, middle class. The father had owned a pub, bar and grill. When the father died, the mother took in the boarders, had some money going. But it didn't really support the family. And unfortunately, after 4 years, she had to give up the house. But she always said to Mary, you want to be a writer, go for it. So when Mary Higgins Clark sold her first short story to the Saturday Evening Post, her mother said, put the money in the bank. It was $1,500. And her idea was that with that $1,500, you can save it because, Mary, you've used up your idea.
She had one idea.
One idea.
I love Mary's quote about that you have in the book about the Bronx.
Oh, yeah. She's great. She said, there are only three places in the world that have a "the" in front of them. There's the Vatican, the Hague, and the Bronx. People just don't get it. The Bronx is beautiful with great people in it.
There's also the Gambia, but she probably wasn't aware of that. We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll talk about some of the other people. Some of these stories are really surprising, like the story of David Yarnell.
I love that story.
And, of course, you have Al Pacino, Milton Glaser, Mickey Drexler, a whole bunch of people who have fascinating stories. You also talk about in this book about when people stopped leaving the Bronx. There was, for a long time, people got to a certain point in their life where they got ambitious. They left. They moved to Manhattan or elsewhere. A few people moved to New Jersey, I think. At a certain point, people thought, well, it's okay to stay in the Bronx. The same sort of thing we saw a little earlier in Brooklyn.
The tide turned. The Bronx, like the country, went through really bad times in the 60s, 70s, 80s. And in terms of the city itself, it was practically bankrupt. So, and you had a drug culture. You had gangs. You had arson. And the parts of the Bronx, the South Bronx, suffered terribly. But the kids who lived through that, and some of them are represented in the book. You have Tat Screw. You have Majora Carter. Renee Hernandez, you know, doctors, writers, urban planners, artists, they're attached to the Bronx.
And I think a lot of our listeners are as well.
Yes, yeah. And it was wonderful. I was speaking to one of the Tats Crew artists yesterday, and he was so proud. He bought one of the first townhouses that were built in the Bronx. And he loves it, and his upkeep is very low. You know, that's the next frontier for renters and buyers, because Brooklyn is gone.
And you remind me with that detail of buying the Bronx. So when you talked about arson in the Bronx, it's so interesting. When you say arson, it's a general term, and you sort of know what it means, you know, to burn down the building to get money from the insurance company. But the detail that Arlene got out of one of the people she talked with was that when the landlord stopped coming around for rent money, you knew arson was next. And you packed up and got out of the building to save your life.
Yeah.
I'm talking with Arlene Alda and Alan Alda. Arlene has written a book called Just Kids, telling it the way it was, an oral history. Oh, Just Kids from the Bronx, I'm sorry. An oral history. It is published by Henry Holt.